It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, new research out of UW-Madison is looking at a specific part of the brain as the basis of a new theory of addiction to things like opiates.
First, when President Obama issued guidelines to strengthen the rights of transgender students last month, it set off a political storm. WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White says it also left transgender students in Wisconsin trying to figure out how to live their lives in a complicated, sometimes hostile climate. She joins us now to discuss the issue. Laurel, good to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me, Judith.
So, Laurel, it seems that we've been talking about the transgender bathroom issue and bills in one way or another for more than a year. So why is this issue getting so much attention once again?
Well, you're right. The transgender bathroom bill that was debated in Wisconsin during the last legislative session has sort of boiled up again because the representative who sponsored it, Representative Jesse Kramer, has said he plans to reintroduce it in the next legislative session. And there's also been some action regarding federal guidance on transgender bathroom policies that the state attorney general has responded to, actually by joining a multi-state lawsuit challenging those guidelines. So there's been a lot of discussion of transgender rights and policy in Wisconsin in the past month or so.
Before we go more into the policies and the legislative aspect of this, you recently spent time with and interviewed some people who are directly affected by this public policy debate for a WPR News feature. Let's listen to that now.
Elle is like a lot of seven-year-old girls. She loves the color pink, sparkles, and ponies. In fact, she just started taking horseback riding lessons.
Because I thought it would be fun.
But there's something that makes Elle different. She was born a boy. She started using her new girl's name at school this year, and she started wearing dresses instead of boy clothes to first grade. When you ask Elle why she wanted to do that, she gives a matter-of-fact answer.
Because I was transgender.
That's a complicated topic for some people, but for Elle, what it means to be transgender is pretty simple.
I'm a boy, but I changed to a girl because I like girl stuff and I wanted to be a girl.
Elle is growing up in a time when transgender rights are one of the most hot-button political issues in the country, and Wisconsin is certainly part of the debate. Last year, Kewaskum Assembly Republican Jesse Kramer introduced a bill banning transgender students from using the bathroom that aligns with their gender identity. He plans to reintroduce it and says otherwise, someone will take advantage of the ability to use the bathroom of their choice.
I could take my daughter, and my neighbor take his daughters. We could go to an open swim at the local high school. We send our daughters into the girls' room to change, get their swimming suits on to go swimming. There might be a 30-year-old guy in there changing right next to them.
Last month, Wisconsin Attorney General Brad Schimmel signed on to a multi-state lawsuit challenging the Obama administration's guidance on transgender bathroom use, calling it an abuse of executive power. 18-year-old Eddie Terrell Wood of Madison says living in a time when your sexuality is so public and so publicly controversial isn't easy.
When it comes to like trans issues and people are fighting back at me about that, it's a bit harder just because like to you, this is an issue of politics, but to me, this is my life every single day.
Wood's school tried to alleviate that stress a little bit by letting her use the bathroom of her choice. A growing number of schools in Wisconsin are implementing transgender bathroom policies. Some transgender students say they'll cope, whether their schools change or not. Liz Elliott LaFleur is an 18-year-old from Milwaukee. Some days, LaFleur identifies as a woman. Other days, a man. LaFleur is attending a college this fall that doesn't have a transgender bathroom policy, but says that's okay.
I'm not going to let my sexuality or gender or anything like stop me. You know, I'm going to face struggles all the time in life. Even when I'm older as a teacher, students might not like me for being the way I am, but, you know, I want to be proud of myself and get the degree I need and be able to teach students whether they like that or not.
LaFleur and other transgender students say they know some people won't understand them. Some might be rude or mean, but despite political debate, drama, and litigation, they say they're going to keep living their lives. The bathroom, they say, is the bathroom. Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio.
So Laurel White is joining us right now. Laurel, how did you find the people that you talked with in that feature?
Sure. So I reached out to a transgender rights advocacy group called GSAFE. And they've done a lot of work all over the state of Wisconsin, helping different schools and school districts navigate transgender bathroom policies. So I reached out to them and I said, hey, are there any students that you think would be willing to speak with me for a feature? I wanted to talk to people from all around the state as much as possible. So they were a great window into that.
And why do you think so much of the attention in this debate is focused on bathrooms?
You know, I think it's interesting because Representative Jesse Kramer, again, who sponsored that bill, has actually said that he's more concerned about the locker rooms and the changing facilities than he is the bathrooms. You know, as you heard in that piece, he's concerned about taking his daughter to a swimming pool and have her changing in the restroom next to someone of a different sex. So, you know, the bathrooms, I think, are the primary focal point here. But it's interesting because the representative actually is concerned about the locker rooms a bit more.
Mm-hmm. So in some ways, maybe bathroom is kind of a shorthand for any place where people are in that kind of close proximity. So, Laurel, you said that Jesse Kramer, representative in the Wisconsin legislature, is planning to reintroduce his bill next term. But in light of the federal guidelines that are now in place, is there any likelihood of, even if they pass, if of them going anywhere?
The federal guidelines?
The bill that Kramer is wanting to promote.
Sure. Well, you know, it's actually it's kind of a tricky legislative situation because the federal guidelines wouldn't actually be law. So if the law in Wisconsin actually passes, I think they would usurp what the guidelines are. Mm-hmm. So that would change everyday experiences, I believe, for transgender students in Wisconsin, if that does pass.
Sure. So just to be clear, the federal guidelines are just that. They are guidelines. They're not actually laws.
Right.
Okay. So did you interview anyone else whose voice you weren't able to include in the feature?
Yeah, so it's very difficult to fit everyone that you speak with into a radio piece. So I was able to fit most everyone into my print story that's on WPR.org. So if folks want to go take a look at that, they can hear from some more voices. One of the other students that I spoke with is a 12-year-old girl from Wanakee, and she's actually the first transgender student to come out in that school district. She came out this past winter. And she told me a little bit about her experience, and she was able to use a gender-neutral bathroom at first, and they actually transitioned her to the girls' restroom this past, I think it was May, so right before the school year wrapped up. And she said she sort of echoed the sentiments that the other students in this story had, which was when they came out, their classmates were generally pretty supportive and accepting and encouraging. So her experience has been very positive.
And there are those federal guidelines that allow for people to use the restroom of the gender that they identify as. There is also a lawsuit from several states, including Wisconsin, suing the Obama administration over those guidelines. What is the status of that lawsuit?
So that lawsuit was filed just last month, shortly after the guidance was issued. These things obviously take time, so that's going to be in progress for quite a while. I did speak with the Attorney General earlier this week for this feature, and he said that he's very optimistic about the outcome of that lawsuit, and he reiterated that he really feels like the Obama administration overstepped their bounds here, that they're essentially trying to make law, but that's not within their purview, that Congress should be the body doing that.
And speaking of that, have there been attempts in Congress to pass bills either for people who identify as transgender to be able to use the bathroom that they identify with that gender or against that?
Well, there's been a lot of action on transgender bathroom policies nationwide over recent months. And I think that that is having an impact on the Wisconsin debate. The students I spoke with are certainly aware of all of that that's happening and trying to take that in as much as possible. And Representative Kramer, who sponsored Wisconsin's bill, has referenced several of the national policies that are in the works. He considers North Carolina's bill, which has been incredibly controversial around the country, as a model. He really thinks that they're doing it right.
And Laurel, did you get to talk with the parents of these transgender students. Did they give you any insight into what this has been for them?
I did. And it was hard when I was editing the piece because I really did want to focus on the students and their experiences. All the students I spoke with, you know, 18 or younger, and in a very formative time in their lives. So I wanted to highlight what it was like for them. But I spoke to parents in almost every instance as well. And the parents, by and large, were actually entirely supportive of their children. And I actually sat down at the kitchen table with the 12-year-old girl from Wanakee with her two parents. And they said that the experience for them was, they didn't want to call it easy, but they said it was surprisingly simple for their son to transition into their daughter. And they were incredibly heartened by the support they received from the community, from their school, from their family and friends. So it was very interesting to get the insight from the parents as well.
Well, Laurel, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Judith.
That was Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter, giving us an update on the ongoing debate over transgender bathroom policy issues. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, the average American throws away $30 each month in the form of uneaten food. We'll talk to Food Friday regular Lori Skelton about ways to cut down on food waste.
First, opioid addiction and overdose has been on the rise in Wisconsin. According to the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, in 2013, Wisconsin saw more people in the state die from drug overdoses than it did from suicide, car accidents, or firearms.
Now, research out of UW-Madison is looking at the science behind addiction by giving more attention to the brain's prefrontal cortex, the part responsible for self-control and planning. According to recent findings, the prefrontal cortex seems to be an important place to study to understand impulsive and reward-seeking behavior.
Brian Baldo joins us now. He's an assistant professor of psychiatry in the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Brian, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I'm guessing that there is a lot of research going on around opioids and addiction because it is such a huge public health problem. How did you decide to pursue this specific type of research?
That's a great question. The overarching theme of our laboratory is to study dysregulated motivation. Now, healthy motivated behavior is essential for survival. For example, imagine a hungry animal seeking out food. Mm-hmm. But as we know, too much of even a good thing is bad. So what happens when motivation becomes dysregulated? And it turns out that there are extensive systems of checks and balances in the brain that keeps our motivated behavior within adaptive limits. But what if those checks and balances fail? That could lead to dysfunctional behavior, as you see in certain types of eating disorders, for example, binges and bulimia or binge eating disorder, and other so-called behavioral addictions, such as pathological gambling, and of course also in substance abuse and addiction.
So those checks and balances, what is keeping one thing in balance and maintaining those checks within the brain?
Well, it seems like specific systems and circuits evolved so that, for example, a healthy adaptive motivated behavior like eating never goes out of bounds, so to speak. You know, imagine early in our evolutionary history, finding a rich source of food was a huge advantage. But if we became too locked in, too focused on eating, maybe we wouldn't pay enough attention to the environment and there would be a risk that a predator might get us.
And so, we might be slower, too, if we've gained too much weight.
Absolutely. And so, exactly. And that's a problem that another problem like addiction that society faces is an excess of eating and positive energy balance or obesity. Perhaps an important thing to remember is that an undergirding idea in addiction biology is that these reward systems evolve to direct us to healthy things like eating, reproduction, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. Drugs of abuse get in there and sort of hijack the system by chemically acting on the same substrates that underlie the function of our natural reward system. And one of those neurochemicals are the opioid peptides.
And so when we have too much of those opioid peptides running around in mm-hmm. our brain, I'm getting out of my depth here, what happens to those normal checks and balances?
No, and that's sort of exactly what might be going on. Opioids are crucial for normal brain function, but when there's an excess, what happens is it throws the system of checks and balances off. And what we identified in our research is that the prefrontal cortex actually is quite an important spot in the brain for opioid actions. They've been studied at sort of downstream parts of the brain quite extensively for years. But we decided to study them within the brain's planning and decision-making and self-control center, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And we found that the opioids produce powerful effects.
And so our brains, those really high-level thinking and planning and deciding parts of our brain are kind of being thrown off for what they would usually do and the ways that they would do it.
Exactly. And the normal function of the prefrontal cortex to kind of keep our behavior within adaptive limits is thrown off if there's an excess of opioid release there. One of the experiments we did, we actually taught our experimental subjects to do a task, and we study, you know, we use rodent models mm-hmm. in our lab. We taught them a task, sort of a self-control task, where they would have to press a lever to get a yummy sugar pellet. But they would have to space and regulate their behavior. They couldn't just jump on the lever and go out of control. And they learned to do that quite well. So they learned to space their behavior so that they maximize the number of sugar pellets that they obtain.
So they learned if they went tap, 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 they weren't going to get as much as if they went tap and then waited and then tap
right.
and then waited. Wow.
Even though during that waiting period, they probably really wanted to press the lever to anthropomorphize a bit. But we found that when we made the animals impulsive by making them a little bit hungry, they kind of lost control over their behavior, and they started tapping the lever quickly, and their behavior became very disadvantageous. But if we blocked opioid systems in the prefrontal cortex and nowhere else, we were actually able to restore their self-control, implying that if there's too much, an excess of opioid actions there, it actually can be one of the important substrates that drives food impulsivity and perhaps by extension impulsivity in pursuing other rewards as well, maladaptively, such as drugs.
Hmm. We're talking with Brian Baldo. He's an assistant professor of psychiatry at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. So how much do we know about what heroin and other opioids do to those circuits in the prefrontal cortex? We've been talking about some of those substances being within the brain naturally, but then if there's this influx from the outside, it would seem like that would have an impact.
Absolutely. And we still don't fully know. As I mentioned, opioids have been studied over the years extensively in other sort of downstream brain sites.
And when you say downstream brain sites, what do we mean?
Well, you can think of the prefrontal cortex as sitting on the top of a neural hierarchy, if you will, a network of structures. And what its job is to do is to take the enormously rich and complex information from an environment and help us to select the optimal, adaptive, and advantageous behavior out of that mix. And it does that in a variety of ways. It helps us to kind of filter out inappropriate behaviors. It helps to keep, you know, task-relevant information online so we can behave optimally. And when you throw off kind of the apex, the prefrontal cortex, mm-hmm. you can imagine sitting at the apex of this hierarchy, then you start to have domino effects downstream. And what we found out, interestingly, is two of the downstream sites that the prefrontal cortex sends connections to seem to act, one as kind of a limiter of motivated behavior and one as a driver of motivated behavior. And what opioids might do is throw off the balance between the limiter and the driver. And as you asked, if you imagine, taking a drug like heroin is all of a sudden you're flooding your brain's natural opioid systems with all this heroin, those systems may very well react and adapt. And that might change the baseline function of those structures and the networks to which they communicate.
So it sounds like sometimes it could actually increase the limiter behavior and sometimes the more impulsive behavior.
Right. So this model we came up with based on some of our experimental results, what we try to do is, first of all, look at it from an anatomy perspective. You know, where are those connections? Where are the circuits? and then to also look at those circuits from a neurochemistry perspective. So not just what are the specific projections, but what are the neurochemicals that act within those projections. And the hope is if we can understand that whole network function, then we might have multiple places to attack the problem. We might be able to prescribe medications that act at multiple nodes of the network. And imagine a scenario, for example, where you can actually give, you know, smaller or more limited doses of different drugs in combination and have a synergistic effect. Because the drugs that we have right now that to try to regulate addiction and relapse and so on are only partially effective. Maybe if we can, you know, manipulate multiple systems at once, we can get a much better clinical outcome. And by understanding the chemical coding as well as the anatomical coding of the network, that might be a step in that direction.
So it sounds like there are a lot of very concrete results that could come out of this research. And it seems also that especially addictive behaviors, like you mentioned, overeating and drug abuse and maybe gambling, things like that, there's often kind of a shaming element for people who suffer from those addictions. It sounds like the more we find out about the underlying causes and how all these chemical things going on in our brains can really drive our behavior in very different directions, maybe it kind of takes some of that out of the shadows too, that people might feel more comfortable getting help.
Absolutely. That's the hope. The brain is an organ like any other, a very complex organ. But if we look at it from a biological perspective, we realize that these disorders emerge from the dysregulated functioning of an organ, just like in any disease. And hopefully that can destigmatize it.
Well, Brian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure. I really appreciate it.
Great. Brian Baldo is assistant professor of psychiatry at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He talked with us about research looking at the relationship between addiction and the brain's planning and decision-making center.
Coming up after the news, Food Friday regular Lori Skelton joins us to talk about some delicious ways to cut down on food waste. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up in this week's Wisconsin News Roundup, we look at why the Government Accountability Board spent no money on outside investigations in the past 2 years.
First, the average American throws away $30 a month in the form of food waste. Food waste is often due to things like food going bad before you can eat it, letting leftovers go uneaten, or cooking only parts of the food you buy.
In 2012, Dana Gunders from the Natural Resources Defense Council, outlined the problem in a report called Wasted, How America is Losing Up to 40% of Its Food from Farm to Fork to Landfill. She also wrote a cookbook called The Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook.
For this week's Food Friday, we gave regular guest Lori Skelton the challenge of reducing food waste in her kitchen using that cookbook as a guide. Lori joins us now to talk about her food waste reduction adventures over the last several weeks.
And it is a reduction adventure. I will be honest right up front. I don't yet have a waste-free kitchen. This takes work. So after what usually gets me into trouble, great intentions, and then I never follow through with what's in the refrigerator, my great intentions are a little bit at a time and see if I can really reduce to the best of my ability, although I don't know if I'm ever going to get a waste-free kitchen. This does require a lot of planning.
Well, I'm guessing also that it's very individual, depending on the person, what ends up getting wasted in their kitchen. So what did you find?
Well, my big problem, of course, is that most of the time I'm cooking for myself. And one of the reasons I wanted to focus on this now is we're getting into high season with the farmers market, and I know I have problems sometimes where my, again, grand intentions are bigger than my time budget, let alone my food budget. Mm-hmm. And right now, for instance, there's one farmer that has a particular type of Italian green that I absolutely adore, and it's only here for a couple of weeks. So I know it's there, and yes, I want to buy lots of it and use lots of it and get it in the freezer, and am I going to do it? Well, that is where the planning involved. All right, that's my problem. Solo diner. And of course, with kids, what happens if you've got a picky eater? Maybe you planned a great meal and you were going to eat a little bit of this on Monday and a little bit of this on Tuesday. And what if on Tuesday your kid says, well, I don't want that tonight for dinner?
I have a little experience in that
Veronica
department.
I think Veronica might be able to feel that way.
So there are so many challenges with reducing food waste in the kitchen. I'm really looking forward to hearing what the audience has to say, how they go about reducing food waste. It's a little bit at a time, and there are some great tips in. It's called the Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook. There are some recipes in there, but a lot of this is simply reminders that sell-by dates or best-by dates are not necessarily hard and fast rules. Yes, it is possible to still use soured milk. If it's been pasteurized, it's not going to kill you. It's reminders like that.
Not in cereal, though. What would you do with it?
Biscuits.
I'm particular about milk.
Biscuits.
Oh,
pancakes,
yeah.
Waffles, which, of course, if you make a bunch of waffles, those can be frozen. One thing that Dana Gunders is really big on is freezing things. Whether it's you've bought something in bulk and you need to break it down for future use, or you've got leftovers that you can't use right away. That said, you do have to be careful with freezing leftovers. You can't just throw them into a plastic bag and throw them in the freezer. They have to be properly cooled, properly stored. If you're freezing something like fresh fruit, say somebody at the farmer's market has got a really great deal on fresh berries, those do need to be prepared and properly frozen. Otherwise, it's just going to end up back in the garbage because they're inedible 6 months later.
So how would you prepare, say, a bunch of fresh strawberries? Because that's one thing. I love strawberries, and sometimes I've gone out picking and come home with a gigantic cartons, and if I'm lucky, I'll turn some into freezer jam and some into compote, and some I'll just eat, but then there's still some left over. But they're very delicate. So what would I do?
First of all, with fresh berries at this time of the year, something that I discovered years ago that really, really works is the minute you get them home, and here again, it involves some planning, because you have to have a little bit of time the minute you get home. You clean out your sink, put in 10 parts water to 1 part basic white vinegar. Nothing fancy. 10 parts water to 1 part vinegar, and soak your berries, your strawberries, your raspberries especially, your blueberries, 10 to 15 minutes, and then rinse them off. That will help retard mold, so you've got some extra time to work with it. Then if after you've had your jam and your shortcake and you've still got berries left and you are going to freeze them, you are going to want to freeze them either put them on a tray so that you've got individual berries, and then put them in a bag and freeze them. So you'll want them frozen before you freeze them, if you will. Hmm. Or you get a container and submerge the berries in sugar syrup. That's something I didn't know before I read this.
What does that do?
Sugar is one of the reasons we talk about canning and preserving with sugar, jams or whatever. Sugar is a preservative. It helps retard some of the bacteria, the mold, the things that can grow on our food. So if you have a chance to make a sugar syrup, you get a container, submerge your fruit in that syrup, freeze them that way, and that will help keep them in the freezer a lot longer.
Well, Lori said earlier that she's eager to hear from listeners about how they use or either avoid food waste or use things that might end up as food waste. We want to hear from you, too. What do you do to cut down on food waste in your kitchen? How do you make sure that you or your family eats all of those delicious leftovers? What kinds of recipes do you use to get rid of leftovers? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take a caller now. We have Lynn on the line in Paloma. Lynn, hi.
Hi. I just always look at my calendar, and I look at what is going on during the week. And if we're not going to be home or we're doing something else with family or friends, you mark that off. And then I just use America's Test Kitchen when I want to experiment, when I have time, and I have can make great recipes. I use the recipes for two, and I just don't buy anything that's not on my recipe list. I really resist going for things that are not there. I'm cognizant of what is in season and what I would love to use, but I really, if it doesn't fit in, I don't buy it.
Lynn, you sound like you're very disciplined. I admire that. No impulse buys.
Right.
Smarter shopping is top of the list for Dana Gunders. Have a list and stick to it. And I admit, I sometimes I buy with my heart rather than my stomach and my calendar. That's if you can stick with a calendar, that is incredible.
It really does make a difference if it's a week where you've got stuff every evening and at best you're going to be grabbing something as quickly as you can, or if you have time to really cook it out all
yeah.
weekend.
When my boyfriend is here on the weekends and we're saying goodbye to one another on Monday morning, that's usually what we do. Is like, okay, are you going to be home this weekend? Do you want to take the leftovers or do I? Because it does come to which one of us is going to use them.
Right. That's smart. And so, Lori, you have been cooking and you've been trying to reduce at home, but you did bring in one of your experimental recipes this time to get rid of some black beans, I think it was.
Right. I admit, this was not a time when I was bringing in a great deal of food because this was really focused on my own kitchen.
We're glad you didn't make extra waste just to make food waste cookies.
One of the things that came out of this that I've gotten very, very fond of is leftovers for breakfast, where if there's, you know, just a little bit of a few things, mm-hmm. not really enough to make a meal, you get up in the morning, you throw those in the pan with some leftover grains, maybe a little broth, and when everything's cooked and you know it's safe to eat, you crack an egg on top, let the egg get just a little bit runny. So I didn't have a lot to bring in. Black beans. I love making beans. Yes, we should be eating more beans. Make a big pot on Sunday and use them throughout the week. Well, I will admit, there are some times when Thursday rolls around and I say to myself, if I see one more bean, I'm going to lose it.
And it's easy to make too many, too, I think, because they swell up.
Yes, they do. And so I was really surprised to see a recipe for black bean brownies. These are gluten-free, and if you use olive oil or coconut oil instead of butter, these can be vegan as well. And it couldn't be easier. You throw your beans and some quick-cooking oats and cocoa powder, brown sugar, maple syrup, oil, vanilla extract, baking powder, and chocolate chips in your food processor or blender. Blitz, put in prepared pan, bake for half an hour. I don't know if I'd call them brownies. I like a brownie to have a very dense, wonderful texture.
It's a very specific texture you think of.
And
brownies.
So everybody who tried these said they're delicious, but I don't know if they're a brownie. The texture for these is a lot lighter, but nobody could taste bean.
That's great.
Nobody. I said there's a secret vegetable, and everybody thought beets?
Yeah.
Nope. Beans. And they were one thing I would love to try. I didn't have a chance to this week. Since I know it works for black beans as a brownie, I wonder if leftover pinto beans mixed with butterscotch chips could make a kind of oatmeal scotchy.
Oh. Wow.
So if I will let you know if it works.
We hope you have some leftover pinto beans.
Well, we're talking right now to Food Friday regular Lori Skelton, talking about some tasty ways to cut down on food waste in your kitchen.
And we're taking your calls, too, at 800-642-1234. How do you cut down on waste in your kitchen? Maybe how do you avoid waste in your kitchen? What do you always end up throwing out? And how do you make sure your family eats up all of those leftovers? What kinds of things do you do in your kitchen that we should try to make sure we're not throwing out food? Call in and share your tips now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation with Lori in just a bit. You're listening to Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up in our weekly Wisconsin News Roundup, we look at how a change in Medicaid might help to close the health gap that Native Americans in Wisconsin face.
Right now, we're continuing our conversation with Food Friday regular Lori Skelton about cutting down on food waste in your kitchen.
Well, we want to know what tips you have for cutting down on food waste. What recipes do you have to use up all the odds and ends in the refrigerator? What recipes do you go to then? And how do you make sure that all those leftovers actually get eaten? Call right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And let's go back to the phones, and Anna in Elkhorn is up. Hi, Anna.
Hi. What I actually do is I take all of my vegetables that are getting rubbery, you know, carrots, celery, anything like that, puree them in the blender, and then add them to spaghetti sauce, like tomato sauce, that then gets frozen, and I use that later in lasagna, spaghetti, whatever, because you can't really eat them raw when they're rubbery, but once they're cooked, I mean, nobody, my family would actually be very surprised at the amount of vegetables that are in my coffee.
Well, hopefully they're not listening right now and your secret will be safe. Lori was nodding as you were saying that. Anna, is that something that came up in the waste-free kitchen?
Absolutely. The idea that wilted is not going to make you sick. A lot of times you can revive a wilted vegetable with 10 minutes in an ice water bath. If maybe it isn't perfect for your crudité plate, it could still be put in a salad. And if it can't be revived that way, then yes, any vegetable pasta sauce is a brilliant way mm-hmm. to use this up.
We make a lot of stir fries, and I'll put, I mean, stir fry is a huge umbrella that pretty much anything will fall under.
Yeah.
So, and it's okay if, like celery, for instance, if I'm going to eat it raw, I want it to be really nice and crisp. But once you cut it up and saute it in a stir fry, it's fine, even if it started out a little on the weak side.
We're the same way with quiche. That's our vegetable there repository there. You can just put whatever it is in there, and there you go.
One thing that I've gotten to really enjoy is making kimchi and sort of have this, anything that can wilt is a great starter for kimchi. Hmm. And I'm also finding it's a great way to use up the parts of a plant that you don't normally use. I've had ramp kimchi on my own table, and I just had it out at a restaurant the other night, where you use the leaves. And you start off by wilting down the things that can be wilted, whether it's leaves or celery tops or leftover lettuce. It generally works out about a half a tablespoon of salt to every pound of vegetables. And you'll start off with the softer stuff on your kitchen counter, and then you can be adding things like carrots or peppers or onions. You can get really, really creative with what you turn into kimchi. And if you're not quite thrilled with the way that it's tasting at the end of it, what will always save it is a squirt or two of sriracha.
Lori's a big sriracha fan.
Yes.
So those that don't know, kimchi is a Korean
fermented cabbage
with some pepper in there.
It's red pepper. It's fermented cabbage at its base, mm-hmm. but I'm finding that you can start playing with fermenting foods on your counter, and it can get really, really fun. The dish I had the other night, it was ramp kimchi, so there's mm-hmm. Korean with Wisconsin, served with crawfish on top of polenta.
Ooh.
So Southern America, Wisconsin, Italy, and Korea all in one plate, and it was delicious.
That sounds really good.
You are mixing it up.
Let's go back to the phones, and Don in Eau Claire is up. Hi, Don.
Hello. I have a comment and a question. My comment is that I was a depression kid and grew up eating everything and never throwing anything away, and so anyway, this is natural, but all peelings, like if you had vegetable peels, carrot peels, celery trimmings, cauliflower or cabbage trimmings, everything was put in a pot, covered with water, cooked for an hour or more, and then strained, and the liquid was used as a vegetable stock for making soups.
And, of course, one of the things that we don't always think about, but if you have got scraps that you are planning to use for stock, throw them in the freezer. Throw your bones in the freezer. And then when you've got enough to make a huge pot of stock, just devote some time on a weekend to doing that, and then you've got loads of lovely, lovely stock to use. But that's a perfect example of throw it in the freezer for when you have the time. Save your bones, save the scraps, and you can have amazing stuff come out of your kitchen.
Lori, are you one of those people who has an extra freezer for stuff like this?
I don't, but I will admit, after reading this book, I'm starting to think about getting one.
I am too. I've been thinking about it for a while, and this would be another reason.
I grew up, we had two chest freezers in our house, one just for fruits and vegetables, and I'm now starting to think it may not be a bad idea to invest in one, because right now my freezer is at capacity.
Mine too. All right, let's take another caller now. We've got John on the line in Milwaukee. Hi there.
Hi.
Hi, what did you want to share?
I have a recipe for banana bread.
Ooh, banana bread. So some old bananas you're taking care of. What do you like about the recipe?
Well, it doesn't waste old bananas that are all mushy and stuff.
Right. So you're using those bananas, and they get mushy pretty quickly. So banana bread is the old standby, and that's one way to go for sure.
And with bananas, you don't even need sugar syrup if you're going to put those in the freezer. Freezing bananas for later is a really great way to use up bananas that are about to go stale on you. Although, don't forget, if it's brown, bananas, apples, potatoes, avocados, if it's brown, it's not a problem. It's not going to kill you. You cut off the bruise or the soft parts and then just eat the rest of it.
Any other ideas for bananas, or I guess avocados or some of those other things besides, well, in this case, banana bread, because I think that's a standby. Everybody loves banana bread, but if you got tired of that, what else could you do, Lori?
Bananas, we never think about this, but anything that you can put into a smoothie will, this time of year, you get, even if it's just Dixie cups and sticks, you make popsicles. And we think about pureeing the berries for those, but we don't think about throwing in bananas. And bananas in a popsicle can be an awful lot of fun.
Oh, and they're so naturally sweet, too.
There you go.
Let's talk, Lori, about were there any things that you could see yourself having as extra in the kitchen that you just couldn't think of what you would do with them?
Again, it's not so much I don't have a strategy to deal with it. It's that I do sometimes think I have more time than I do. One thing I really have to guard against is just not being as organized in the kitchen as I would like to be. I'm almost to the point of getting the chalkboard paint to paint on my cupboard so I can write on my cupboards what I've got in stock, because I'm notorious for thinking, oh, shoot, I need to pick up such and such, and then I get home, open the refrigerator, oh, there's half a can of it still waiting for me to use. So it's not so much that I haven't found the right way to use an ingredient, is that I need to be more organized in my kitchen.
And does the Waste Free Kitchen Handbook have some ideas for organization?
It's got great ideas. And guess what? There's an app for that.
Who would have guessed?
From the USDA, as a matter of fact. It's called Food Keeper, and it's how you can keep track of, is it still good? Has it spoiled? A range of things. And it gives you strategies for keeping better track of what's in your kitchen.
Sounds like a good plan. And Lori, do you think you're going to change going forward? You've made this Herculean effort and you discovered it was pretty hard. So for the rest of us out there who haven't even done what you've done so far, what do you suggest to get going?
This would be a really great project to take on with friends. And even if that means, oh my gosh, the street has a potluck once a month where everybody brings their leftovers. Don't try and do this alone. Ask for suggestions and have some fun with it.
Well, Lori, thanks so much for joining us today.
Absolutely.
That was Lori Skelton, one of WPR's most passionate cooks and a Food Friday regular. She joined us to talk about tips to cut down on food waste in the kitchen. You can find her recipe for sneaky black bean brownies on the Central Time Facebook page. Just search Central Time on WPR on Facebook.
And you can let us know what you do with all your food leftovers, your tips and techniques. We'll take them on Facebook.
Well, 200 years ago tomorrow, Mary Shelley had a dream that inspired her bone-chilling masterpiece, Frankenstein.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say it's probably more of a nightmare since it was about Frankenstein, but I guess it's good for the literary world that she didn't wake up before she got to the good stuff.
Mary Shelley's not alone. Other books have been inspired by dreams as well, including Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and the Twilight series by Stephanie Meyer.
Interesting that most of these must have been kind of creepy dreams. I guess the Twilight dream, I remember reading about that, and that was sort of a loving thing in a field. But the Mary Shelley dream, that must have been pretty intense.
And don't even get started on Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. So Britain's The Guardian newspaper has a quiz you can take about how dreams have played a part in the plots of many books and poems, too. You can take the test yourself at the Central Time Facebook page. How'd you do on that quiz, Veronica?
You're just trying to embarrass me. I only got one right, and it was the Harry Potter question.
Well, and I only got 6 out of 12 right, but I did not get the Harry Potter one right. So maybe we should team up on a trivia quiz sometime.
No, I thought I was a reader who had read widely, but apparently not when it comes to dreams.
Well, on Monday, we are going to talk about great summer reads, and we're going to ask you to weigh in, too. So make sure to tune in then.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.